I'm Bob Supnik of Sun Microsystems, and on behalf of Sun Microsystems, welcome. Thank you all for coming. When Selim invited me to make this talk, he couldn't have known that I would be here at Sun, and so the opportunity to say this is another one of these pleasing coincidences from the whole thing. I'm going to talk about using simulators to reconstruct and preserve computing's past. And one of the problems with the talk, and as you'll see, one of the problems with demonstrating the simulators, is that all of the things that sort of attract us to old computers, the blinking lights, the video games, are missing. You're also missing the one-ton piece of equipment and the electricity bill that makes you an NSTAR favored customer and the air conditioning unit the size of this room. But it is kind of a different approach. And the reason I did simulators was for a couple of reasons. First, it's much more accessible. Now anyone who has a laptop or a Macintosh or a Unix or Linux workstation can carry the history of computing around with them, access it, and play with it. And secondly, I'm not really an electrical engineer. I only play one on TV. And the thought of opening up one of these machines with their 50,000 volt reference voltages inside their CRTs and saying, gee, I wonder what that does, didn't really appeal to me. Although it has been said of C that it provides enough rope to hang yourself, and of C++ that it provides enough rope to hang yourself and your three nearest neighbors, it is a lot safer for those of us who are reasonably inept with their hands than trying to build a real machine. Okay, there it is. So I'm going to tell you about SimH, where it came from, some of the development history, and in particular the role of the internet in converting it from my hobby project into something that's become a much more elaborate and much more interesting project. Then a bit about the internals and how, if you wanted to build a simulator, either with SimH or on your own, you would do it. How the whole computer history ecosystem functions today. Some demonstrations, which, as I said, are probably going to be a bit on the boring side, unless you're, you know, particularly interested in how Unix looked 35 years ago, which is remarkably how it looks today, by the way, and where we can go from here. So SimH is an internet-based collaborative project. There's about 30 people who participate on a semi-regular basis, and the focus is preserving computers and software of historic interest by building simulators and collecting the software and making it accessible. SimH is not the only framework for simulation. There's a marvelous framework called, I believe, MAME, which focuses on arcade games, and then there are individual simulators for other machines. But SimH is what I've been working on. So it's a portable application framework for implementing simulators. It's about 24 simulators that are run on that framework. It's a collection of demonstration software, and then a growing set of papers and presentations on all the weird things that have been learned trying to get this stuff to work. And you can find it on the web at simh.trailingedge.com, part of the Trailing Edge family of websites, run by a gentleman named Tim Schaba, who is also one of the stalwarts and whom I have never met. So SimH runs on a variety of platforms, ranging from Linux and Windows through Mac OS. Out of loyalty to my past, it also runs on VMS and DEC Unix. And someone's actually ported it to OS 2, and someone's ported it to Windows CE. So you can actually have a handheld PDP-11 that you can carry around.
I've got one with me.
Oh, all right. I think that's just about as cool as the guy who converted his 780 into a bar. So this is the list of simulators that are presently implemented. DG 16-bit machines, almost everything that DEC ever built, and ALF is actually under development because it is Alaska to be a historic machine real soon now. The GRI 909, a bunch of IBM machines, some HP 16-bit machines, all of the Perkin Elmer or Interdata machines, Honeywell, the MITS Altairs, the Royal McBee, and the Scientific Data Systems, more than two dozen machines in all. Someone pointed out to me it is rather biased towards the East Coast of the United States. Only the HP and the SDS machines and the MIPS really come from somewhere else. Well, I'm an East Coast kind of guy, what can I say? A lot of these are actually out in the lobby for you to take a look at. There's an HP 2100 exhibit out here, or an HP 1000. They renamed it just to keep people confused. There's a bunch of VAXs out there, PDP-8, et cetera. In terms of what we've collected for software, we have the PDP-1 running Lisp and DDT, which are two of the earliest interactive systems ever built. And as Selim showed, Space War is underway. We have the earliest extant versions of Unix, which are versions 5, 6, and 7. Versions 1 to 4 are, as far as anybody knows, irrevocably lost. According to Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson, they're gone forever, which is one of the rationales for why this project exists. We have InterData Unix, which was the first port of Unix. Unix was not developed to be portable. And when it was ported, it was much a surprise to the developers as anyone else. We have the classic PDP-10 time-sharing systems, most of the PDP-11 operating systems, as many of the PDP-15 operating systems as we've been able to find, ditto for the 8, VAX VMS and all of the VAX Unix flavors, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of software available. The single largest issue in getting more software has to do with IP and licensing. Software is not free, and the history of these things can be very, very tangled. It took close to 5 years of intensive lobbying with at the time the Santa Cruz organization. I think you all know those people now. To get them to release the rights to run Unix version 5, 6, and 7. And they did it in an interim between when they were owned by Caldera and when they turned into the IP suing company they are today. The descendants of all of Data General software is owned by some company locally. No one uses it anymore. Nobody makes it. They won't release the licenses. HP has been fairly reluctant to let it go. Their software go, lest, you know, somehow there be intellectual property rights connected with their 1977 diagnostics that are relevant, and so on. So the reason there's so much DEC software... Sure. Okay. Thank you. Or green. Perfection. So now I should be able to go to slideshow mode.
Wow.
Thank you. Appreciate it. The reason there's so much DEC software is that I was a DEC vice president for a lot of times, and it was really, really convenient to write the releases and then have a DEC vice president sign them. It worked like a charm. So why are we doing this? Why am I doing this? One of them facts... Simple facts is that computing's past is disappearing every day because machines are being scrapped, software and documentation are being thrown out, media is becoming unreadable, mag tapes deteriorate and print through, and frankly, the people who developed our leading-edge machines are dying. So we are losing the artifacts, the ability to reconstruct the artifacts, the software, and the folklore. And Being a trained historian, something that I rarely admit to, I actually do believe in the Santayana principle that those who do not study the past are condemned to repeat it. And frankly, in my career, I have seen hardware and software engineers reinvent not only the breakthroughs of the past, and of course try and patent them, and hence Selim's consulting business, but frankly, they reinvent the mistakes. And really... There is no difference, for example, between what you need to think about in order to make 8K words of PDP-8 memory function efficiently and what you need to do to make a modern microprocessor function efficiently, which also has only about 8K words worth of instruction cache. And if you can make things run out of that instruction and data cache, you've got a 3 gigahertz machine. If you make it run out of the second level cache, you have a 300 megahertz machine. You make it run out of memory, you've got a 30 megahertz machine. which is why, by the way, your PCs run the way they do. Well, the answer as to why PDP-8s and modern machines are different is that nobody bothers to think about how to optimize for small memories. And the last point is that the relative lifespans of hardware, software, and data are very, very different. Hardware architectures come and go. Right? You can't buy a PDP-11 anymore. You can't buy a VAX anymore. Pretty soon you won't be able to buy an Alpha. But the software and data that those machines created have much longer lifespans, 15 to 50 years. Pharmaceutical projects, 15 years. Military subsystems, 25 years. Airframes, 50 years. So when someone wants to go interpret the CAD drawings from a Boeing 747's original design, which was done back in the mid-60s, they may have a serious problem on today's equipment, running the software, transcribing the data, and so on. So, you know, what's going to run the BART signs when the last PDP-8 out there breaks down? Well, okay, so you could replace that. There's actually a much more serious case I know of where there's a nuclear power plant in Ontario whose refueling system is run by a PDP-8. What happens when that breaks down? But the real question I get is, okay, why are you doing this? Okay, so you wrote articles. Why did you choose that set of systems? Okay, here's the truth. The first fact of the matter is the LGP30 was the first computer I ever saw. Right? I was about 12 years old, and my future brother-in-law, who was going to go in computers, took me into the office he was working at, and there was this thing about the size of this desk, which has about as much memory as your wristwatch and probably less computing power. And whoa, first computer. The 1620 was the first computer I ever programmed. That's probably true for a lot of people in my generation that they saw them in college. The PDP-7 and the PDP-8 were the first machines I ever wrote complete projects for. The Nova was the first computer I ever did a complete system design for. The GRI-909 was simply the weirdest machine I ever worked on in my life. It has one instruction. And, by the way, it would not exist as a simulator if it wasn't for Selim, who founded the manual. I don't know if... Did you ever succeed in finding a real one?
I have one.
You have one?
Yes.
Oh, cool. That's great. Does it work?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But probably it's complete. And
did any more manuals ever show up?
I might have more manuals. The set that I lent you was from... I got those from a guy that gave me a big pile of manuals and just happened to have them. But I'll check.
Well, somewhere in my attic is probably the last extant program for the GRI-909, which was a real-time system to control growing crystals at MIT. The SDS-940 is in there is because I've always had this sneaking fondness for 24-bit machines. There never was one that worked well or was successful in the marketplace. And really the hope when doing the SDS-940 was to be able to reconstruct one of the pioneering time-sharing systems, Project Genie. And then I worked at DEC for 22 years, so there's going to be a lot of DEC machines. And why did I write SimH itself? Well, first of all, Larry made me do it. All right, Larry Stewart at DEC Research pointed out in 1993 this problem of the disappearance of computers, and of course in the classic style of research said, why don't you do something about it? I fell for that one. Also, it was becoming a lot harder to find VAXs to do microcode and assembly language programming on. You know, I had just finished up Alpha, and VAXs were about to go away. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. The last major software project I had done before SimH was porting Dungeon. So I needed an excuse to learn C, and everybody assured me that with my assembly language background, I would find it extremely comfortable. And besides, simulators aren't difficult, we know that. And that was 11 years and 125,000 lines of code ago. So the project goals were all around preservation, and they were all around the software. We wanted to make the software bases accessible again for study so that if you want to understand Unix and its evolution, you can now go back, take V5, V6, V7, which come with sources, and study them. In terms of how I got started, I took the advice of a well-known songwriter of the day. So let's see if I can figure out where this really is. Where his supposedly it was going to give me the time. Let's see. There we go.
Plagiarize. Let no one else's work evangelize. Remember why the good Lord made your eyes, so don't shade your eyes, but plagiarize, plagiarize, plagiarize.
Of course, in this day of IP, there is one little thing you have to add to that.
Be sure always to call it, please, research.
So, what I did is basically go back to a design of my own, almost 25 years ago, called Mimic. Mimic was an RTL simulator from the late 60s. And one of the great ironies is that Mimic has disappeared. I have partial paper copies in my attic. We can find no electronic source. Just started in on the well-known classic mini computers that were well-documented. And then, okay, along came the Internet. So what happened with the Internet? Oops. The Internet, people once speculated the Internet was going to make a global city out of the world. It hasn't. What it's done is actually created a million virtual global villages. And computer history is one of those global villages. I'm sure Elvis Presley stamp collectors are as well, and there's probably more of them. But initially, the news groups and the mailing lists that Salim mentioned were the starting point. But the web is what catalyzed the whole thing, because it made the activities of private collectors and hobbyists visible and accessible to everyone. Document repositories, simulation systems, software stashes, all of this became knowable. And this is how I was able to find people with experience. As a result, SimH morphed from this one-person hobby project into a collaborative effort of more than 30 people, 90% of whom I have never met. So this is the first time Salim and I have ever met, I think, except for Al Kossow and Megan Gentry. Most of the people who work on this project have never seen each other. So the ecosystem that sort of makes this all possible includes, first and foremost, the private collectors. Without the activities of people like Selim and say, Max Burnett in Sydney, Australia, who has the largest collection of deck equipment in private hands, Paul Pierce, who has this marvelous collection of IBM gear up in Oregon, Carl Friend, right here in Boylston, who has a great private museum of data general gear. All of this stuff would vanish without the private collectors. And also, most of the work in preserving documents has been done by private individuals as well. I wanted to show you one of the largest stashes that's on the Internet, which is Al Kossow's. And as you can see, there is an enormous collection of machines that have been documented in great detail. If you have a hankering to go simulate an EAI analog computer, the prints and the manuals are now online, as well as academic machines from MIT and Harvard and Stanford and so on, military computers like Lockheed and Raytheon and Sylvania and so on. Just as an example of the kinds of things you can find in this archive that might be of interest to people who normally live here. Here's an interesting document. Draft 1.0 of the Sun 1 reference manual, complete with somebody's hand annotations on how it changed. New figure is coming, it says. Interestingly enough, it says it has a 3 megabit Ethernet. I'm not sure that there ever was a 3 megabit Ethernet actually shipped, but that's what it says.
So Bob will find a link to this at Trailing Edge?
Yes, you'll find this on my site along with links to all of the other simulation projects that I'm aware of. One of the very best is a project called Hercules, which gives you a virtual 360, 370, or 390. On your desktop. It's only your problem to figure out where you're going to get an operating system license. The Cyber Cray project, if you've always had that hankering to have your own supercomputer without the liquid cooling, And there are many, many others. There's a guy in Australia who's very close to bringing up an IBM 7094 running IBSYS. I see the blank looks of incomprehension. I'll just go on. restoration projects are very important as well. Two PDP-9s have been restored, one in Rhode Island and one in Paris. The Computer History Museum restored a 1620 and is working on getting the PDP-1 back online. And there are probably many others that I don't know about. There are fewer institutions that can help in this area than one would really like. Many of the computer collections that are put together are simply static displays. There's no real interest in making them available for research or helping out people who are interested in the hobby. The two most notable exceptions are the Computer History Museum in California, in Mountain View, which now has a formidably nice research collection available because the core of it is the DEC archive, DEC's 40-year history of all its documents, which I arranged to have donated as a sort of a parting shot. And the Rhode Island, they also have DEC's machine collection, which otherwise I have no idea what would have happened to it. It was in this five-story warehouse in Kentucky, Rhode Island, New Hampshire rather, and one of my great adventures was going up there to inventory it. And you had to go up in the cherry picker up to five stories and step out on the scaffolding and lift up and see what's there. Another place more local is the Rhode Island Computer Museum and its allied Rhode Island Retro Computing Society. People down in Providence have a very interesting collection. And then the last piece of the ecosystem, and this is one of the newest, is eBay. Because all the junk in the world eventually ends up for sale on eBay. And there's not a lot from old computers at any given time, but cumulatively there's a huge amount. For example, right now there's a PDP-8 complete fiche set up for sale. It's about the only interesting item. Maybe.
Sometime recently there seemed to be basically the entire pieces of the PDP-8. It almost looked like somebody had taken it apart and were selling it piecemeal. Which was very...
Vandals.
Yeah.
Vandals. So here's a case study of sort of how the Internet plays into it. And this is a partial diagram of what it took to recover the operating system and operational software for the 18-bit PDP family, which was very difficult. Few of them were built. The last was built in 1977. So it started with the old DEC archive. But the first piece of software was found in an attic in Princeton, New Jersey, on an old PDP-10 backup tape that was then sent to Paul Pierce in Oregon for transcription. And the resulting bits, which were, of course, a PDP-10 backup, then came back to another person at DEC who decoded them from raw bits to provide the first simulator. Then the next was paper tapes discovered at the McMaster Physics Lab in Hamilton, Ontario, which were shipped out to California to be transcribed, and that got us focal in the diagnostics. Then another collector, Dave Gesslin, who runs the PDP8.net site, found a bunch of PDP15 DEC tapes with the advanced software system. DEC tapes are one of the best archival media ever invented. They seem to be indestructible, unlike real mag tapes. They seem to be readable no matter how long they've been stored and how badly they've been mistreated.
An experiment we ran at one point in the RP group was we took a DEC tape and unrolled it down the length of ML55 and then went down with a three-hole paper tape punch and punched at random points on one side and at random points on the other, making sure the holes didn't line up because the data is stored redundantly. And we put the thing back on a reader and it read.
Well, the good news is you can read it. The bad news is you pretty much can only read it on a DEC tape drive. And so this is one of those cases where having real hardware was very important. So we now had the advanced software system. We didn't have its bootstrap. And it took 2 years of searching and talking to people on the Internet before the bootstrap was discovered for a different system, mind you, in Grenoble, France. And the guy there had no paper tape reader, so he transcribed it by putting it down on a flatbed scanner in sections and then wrote a program to get the paper tape put back, sent it to me. We debugged it because it was the wrong bootstrap. And that's what that got ADSS up, except that it needed documentation that we didn't have, which came from my friend Matt down in Sydney, Australia, who sent it to California where it was scanned and put online. Then, that gets us through 2000, the restoration project for the PDP-9 in Grenoble turned up another operating system called DOS 15, and they were able to read that because they now had working deck tapes, but there was a missing piece that sort of constructed the disk image, and that the fellow there, Hans Pufel, put together by reading the documentation and reverse engineering, and he found a bug. I'll talk about that bug later, but he found a bug. He generated the first DOS 15 ECO in 30 years. And then, in 2004, a more advanced version called DOS XVM turned up for sale on eBay and was bought, transcribed, and we now have DOS XVM. We're still not done. There's still pieces missing from this story, namely the RSX and MUMS operating systems. But you know, it's like the X-Files. The truth is out there. So how is SimH? SimH is put together in a very simple way. It's a hierarchical simulation package with a central framework. It says there's a collection of devices, one of which is special, called the CPU. Devices have registers for storing state, and those registers have names. They also have numbered units, and the units can have data sets for storing data. Now, this is where one of the reasons SimH shows its age. I mean, this should have been a much more symmetrical design. It should have been the case that it was just strictly hierarchical and recursive so that devices could have data and units could have registers. And there's a whole bunch of really distasteful workarounds for that now. But, you know, the design is what it is. The data sets are mapped into a uniform set of host containers, so basically there are concrete data types in 16, in 32, etc., and you choose the next one up. The simulator is single-threaded. This was one of the consequences of trying to make it very, very, very portable, is there was no such thing as a portable threading package that would span VMS, Unix, Windows, and Mac. So the asynchronous behavior is all modeled explicitly. That is, time is tracked in some sort of units. The device events are scheduled. There's a scheduler that runs within the program, and it calls the appropriate event handler. So true asynchronous behavior is simulated, but it is simulated with a pseudo-scheduling mechanism. And lastly, the common devices are implemented through libraries that hide the OS dependencies. So we have libraries for disks and tapes, terminal multiplexers, and most recently Ethernet. And we're working on libraries to support graphics, access to raw devices, and access to blink and light consoles. What Selim built for the one, there's, you know, a number of people who are building replica consoles, either through the parallel port or the USB port, and we'd like to get a general mechanism for being able to use them because they are so cool. So if you want to write a simulator, there's really three simple steps. This is not a 12-step program. You know, you can get by with only 25% as much effort. First of all, you need documentation. And you need primary documentation. Never trust a document that's derived from another source. So if there's a handbook, forget it. Get the original maintenance manual. Prior simulators are not to be trusted. You know, this is historical research. You need primary sources. It also helps if you can find somebody who knows how the thing is supposed to run, because there's an enormous amount of folklore about how these things work. And then you have to gather the software and you have to transcribe it. So it helps to have friends like Selim who have paper tape readers and card readers and access to RKO5s or other weird media. And then you have to read all this stuff. And you have to read all of SimH's documentation as well. There's a lot of starting points for this on the internet. If you just do a search on your machine or you start from Alcalson's archive, you can get an enormous amount of material. The second step is implementation. You've got a couple of critical design decisions. You know, how are you going to decode and execute instructions? One simple piece of advice is don't waste time optimizing. PCs are just going to be faster next year. How are you going to model the I/O subsystem is very critical. you really have to do a lot of very accurate work there. You may find that you needed to do almost a signal-by-signal emulation to get it right. Interrupts and exceptions are an important part of that. And one of the ugly truths is that hardware mechanisms for this for handling exceptions like microtraps are really, really well implemented by things like long jump and really, really badly handled by things like try, except, finally. Sorry, Jim Gosling. The other problem I've always had with Java is it doesn't have an unsigned data type. Critical for simulation. And then lastly, you have to decide whether how much you're going to invest in doing debug facilities. You're going to use these debug facilities not for new programs, but to get the old programs to tell you what's wrong with your simulator. And debug is always the longest and hardest process. There's hand test cases, that's how you get out the stupid bugs. There's diagnostics, that's how you get out the straightforward bugs. But we used to say at DEC that diagnostics are the set of programs that a hardware system will run no matter how broken. And really, the only proof that you've got a simulator that works is that you can run operating systems and applications. Operating systems are superb diagnostics. They really are. But they're reporting mechanisms, you know, which are crash, hang, die, rollover. They really do leave something to be desired. So a typical large simulator, it seems, from my experience, and maybe I'm just a careless coder, has about 100 bugs between the time I get a clean compile and the time I've got the operating system running. And the last 20 are found with the operating system itself. That's why the simulators all have these extraordinarily strong debug tools, including, you know, stepping and save and repeat and infinite numbers of breakpoints and instruction traces and so on. What you'll find, though, is that the devil is all in the details because you're dealing with the picture of the elephant. So, for example, you may find that after assembling all this hardware documentation, it's not complete. When I was bringing up XVM DOS for the PDP-15, it would run and then crash, and then it would run and then it would crash. I could not figure out why. And I went and read the sources, and in great detail in the sources for XVM DOS, it explains that in 1974, some ECO had been put through called the reentrancy ECO that gave this machine, which had no stack, some limited ability to do reentrant software. The only problem was they never bothered to document it in any manual, nor did they bring the print sets up to date. So that was a bit of a poser. Sometimes this can block you completely. We have the sources for the classic CTSS compatible time sharing system of 1962, one of the most important software systems in the history of computing, still exists on 7-track mag tapes at MIT. We can't bring it up because the special modifications that IBM did to the 7094 are not documented, or are not documented anymore. We've talked to IBM, and they just draw blank. They said, what? You expect us to have things from 45 years ago? That, to me, is very scary. Documentation can just be wrong. It can also be misleading or false. HP's 1000 series, or 2100 series, says in every manual since the beginning of time that the instructions for I.O., the test flag, skip on flag set, and skip on flag clear, don't take the option that all the other I.O. instructions do to clear the flag. Says so. Doesn't work that way. Oh, yes, it does. Because it saved them a gate in the original implementation not to make that check. And the RTE4 operating system depends on this fact. So what started out as, I'm going to save a gate when gates counted, and which never got caught up in the documentation, now becomes an operating system dependency for the poor guy who's trying to bring up RTE4. Software may be incomplete. We already talked about the ADSS bootstrap. Project Genie for the SDS-940, which is, again, one of these seminal time-sharing systems, we have all the sources. What we don't have is the system builder. We don't have the piece of software that says, okay, I've assembled all this stuff. Now, where does it go on the drum? How do you lay out the drum so the thing will run? Because Project Genie was a one-of-a-kind system, and it probably never ever grew that way. It probably was sort of built piece by programs that were thrown away. You may run into problems that software paths are untested. When the PDP-10 simulator was built, and we went to install the last version of TOPS 10.704, it wouldn't work. And this was traced down to a clear and obvious bug in the install code. I mean, it just could never work. Could never have worked. And you say, how did this happen? Well, the last version came out 6 years after the last PDP-10 was ever built. This was purely for upgrades. No one obviously ever did a full install. And it didn't work. You may run into the problem that simulator configurations can be a lot more interesting and rich than real hardware. As I said, when we got DOS 15 running, when Hans got DOS 15 running, the first thing he did was to take the simulator and say, oh, well, let me have the biggest disk I can. And these were fixed head disks, about this big in real life, that held a whopping 256K words and cost about $12,000 in 1970 dollars. So that's about $120,000 today. And he said, well, give me eight of them so I can have 2 megawords. Right? You know. DOS 15 hung. So he went to trace it, and when he got to the sizing loop, there was a clear bug that the sizing loop, in fact, had no exit. It assumed that at some point it would find that there wasn't a disk, because nobody at DEC could have afforded to put together a configuration of this size. And no user did either. And that became our first DOS patch. Timing dependencies are an enormous problem, particularly as we move into graphics, but they exist everywhere. We've found in trying to bring up the HP operating systems that if the line printer didn't respond within a very precise window, the operating system assumed that it was hung. And then there may be undocumented hardware dependencies. In trying to bring up PDP-11 Berkeley Unix, BSD-211, I found that the large disk controllers wouldn't function because the large disk controllers had an error in how they implemented interrupts. They managed to implement interrupts in such a way that if you set an interrupt, you couldn't clear it. Even if you turned interrupts off, it wouldn't go away. Because somebody wanted to save a gate. And the driver depended on it. So until the simulator was rewritten to be accurate to the gate level, it couldn't run BSD. In terms of the kinds of trade-offs you make in implementation, the rules are really simple. Accuracy is more important than performance. You need to implement a specific system, not the architecture. As an example, the PDP-11 came in over its lifetime a dozen models, at least, maybe in terms of distinct CPU types, probably. And one of the operating systems, M+, determines this type by running the machine through a sieve of incompatibilities, in the theory being that at the end there'll be one. Well, if your simulator is a hodgepodge of features from various models, you're either going to get several or you're going to get none. And it won't be able to identify what machine you have. So my advice is always take an accurate approach at the black box level. You don't have to do the logic equations inside the ALU, but you should do the basic mechanisms of the data path and its registers correctly. Sometimes you have to. In the Honeywell 316, there's a class of instructions that don't appear to be microcoded, but really are. And it took reading the logic prints and implementing the actual logic equations to reproduce the behavior of this generic A instruction set for programs that sort of knew what these undocumented instructions did. So following the microcode, if it's available, or the logic prints, and including the fine-grained detail is important. And this may influence your choice. The reason, for example, that the VAX simulator is a simulator of a sort of a middle lifespan VAX called CVAX is I was the project leader. I had the microcode. I had the design spec, the chip spec. I also had the specs for all the support chips, and I actually had the behavioral model that had been built for the complete system. So, you know, that it made sense to do that because I had enough material to be sure of being able to get it right. There are always real-world interactions. The simplest one is simulators need to keep time accurately. The SimH framework provides a way of calibrating your real-time clocks to the wall, and also for calibrating your overall simulation loop to the wall if you're trying to do real-world timing for graphics and so forth. And you have to be prepared that people may want more than what the original simulator did. The original VAX simulator reflected what the hardware could do, which was the biggest disk was about a gig, and the memory was 64 meg. Well, I have had users who have said, no, won't do. So, and now, even though the VAX it's modeled on couldn't do this, the simulator will do 512 megs of memory and disks up to 1 terabyte. So I'm very briefly going to demonstrate these things. As I said, I apologize for just how boring this all is, but this is what computing looked like in the good old days. So let's start with the PDP-11, and this is a fairly elaborate PDP-11, as you can see. It's got every peripheral known to man and a few that probably aren't. And I'm going to configure this to run the earliest version of Unix that ever existed. Or excuse me, that still exists, not ever existed. Unix version 5. Okay, so we have our prompt. Let's see if we can... I may have typed one character too many. I did. And in the great model of Unix security. But it is recognizably Unix, right? You know, if I... But things were a little different. It's not... Let's see. It's changed here. Somehow between version 5 and version 6, they decided it was just too much to type 5 characters. So let's go to user games. And let's play chess with a 1973 PDP-11. And you can do it.
Are you running it at 1970 speeds?
No. I'm running it at whatever natural speed this thing runs at, which is probably about 10 times or more real speed. So,
is there an option to set it to the real speed?
There can be, depending on the simulator. This one happens not to, because most PDP-11 software doesn't need it. But part of the same graphics package that implements... Space War implements Lunar Lander. So we're going to have to be adding this ability to slow things down very shortly. And by the way, you still need to sync to make sure that the file system is intact. Okay, so let's flash forward now a couple of years and around the globe to New South Wales and the problem of Richard Miller, who wanted to have a Unix machine but couldn't afford to buy an 11. So he bought this thing called the Interdata 732, which was probably the first 32-bit minicomputer, and then said, well, I better get Unix running on it. So he ported Unix, which is something that the original authors thought was impossible. And, okay, so we've now done that. Same great graphics, security story. But you can have, there is, in the saved image, his original mail message to you from 1978 saying, welcome, you have got another Unix system running. And if I'm not mistaken, again, it looks a lot like Unix. This is now, of course, Unix version 6. Changed here is, oops, no, it's not there. Sorry, changed here, user. Sorry. That must be a V7 thing. But again, all of these distributions come with sources. So if you want to basically follow along with the book, you can. Yes?
Can you possibly raise the bottom of that window?
Oh, of course. I'm sorry, Megan. There we go.
Thank you.
So let's also continue to hack around in the 70s and run a PDP-10. So let's see, this should be T10. Let's see.
Out of curiosity, one of those units is we typed the date command with having concept of what 2004 is able to do that.
That's a good question. I don't know. I think Unix is was Y2K compliant. The one you're about to see.
I remember the TOPS 10 into the world party though, so
we didn't. Okay. Yeah, well, sorry.
If you're really into it, you don't have to ask, right?
Hang on a minute. I just have to figure out which file I need here.
Capital T, maybe?
Yeah. I could have sworn I did these all somewhere.
T10_703.
Yeah, that should do it. What? Oh, there. Damn. What did I do here? I have to excuse. Oh, I know what it is. My apologies. I arranged this in a different way. There it is. T10703.io. All right. Back to our previously scheduled mistakes. So again, this is. Why are we reloading? I'll say this is scheduled, and this is an example where, in fact. The date doesn't work. So TOPS 10 was not, in fact, Y2K compliant, never has been. So the simulator will automatically pretend it's today's date in 1999 if you just take the default dates and times. So you can prove that you are visibly running, excuse me, good old TOPS 10, familiar to most of us who did time sharing in the 1970s. This is actually a fairly big TOPS 10 system. It's got a mega word and so forth. And you could fit the whole thing basically in a corner of your laptop. In fact, if you look at the Unix version 5, the entire disk image, including all the sources, is smaller than this PowerPoint presentation. So one last one. This one takes a little longer, and this is the VAX. This is probably the most popular simulator, and it's quite an extensive one because it permits you to build a big system. So if we say do for those of you who ever used a VAX, you'll remember this long song and dance it goes through. And it really is, you know, a system. It knows what's on the cue bus. It's happy. And if we boot, it will go through the VMS bring up, and you'll see one of my guilty secrets, which is I don't have a license for this one. You can get one of the reasons that we did the VAX is that you can get a hobbyist license for VMS for free. If you're a member of what used to be DECUS and is now called Encompass, or has that been changed too, Megan? Anyway, the users group, and they'll send you a hobbyist kit CD for $30 that includes the operating system as well as C compiler and a whole bunch of tasteful applications. So here's VMS coming up, and this is how, for the first and only time in history, you can get a 6.9's operating environment on your PC. And if I'm not mistaken, I can probably still log into it. Yeah. Now, what's been done with this is, to actually complete the story, is various people have implemented Ethernet. They have shown that we can run local area VAX clusters, so you can cluster your simulators. You can cluster the simulator with real VAXs too.
Who gets the core of this?
Good question. And most recently, the guy who's behind this, David Hittner, figured out how to do this over wireless.
A LAN party.
So here's VMS running fairly happy. I'll shut it down cleanly so it won't complain the next time. Again, one of the things that you'll notice is this is remarkably faster than a VAX system of its contemporary age. And it's not because the simulator is, in fact, running so much faster from an instruction time. It's that the I.O. is so much faster. Modern I.O. Modern disks are so much faster than the 1980s disks that these things all worked on, that it's just amazing. So... although this is intended as an educational project, it has some real-world applicability. First of all, it's gotten a lot bigger. Many more platforms, many more people, up to 32-bit systems, and we are working on 64-bits. It's really quite spooky to see an alpha CPU running on your laptop. It's developed some unexpected uses. Basically, the people who maintain PDP-11 operating systems like 2.11 BSD now basically use SimH as their development platform because it's so much more convenient than a real PDP-11 is and so much faster. And there are a number of people who are using it as a replacement for VAX hardware. I know of a government development program involved in military activities. Probably shouldn't go any further than that. Where they reported to me that by taking out their VAX and using SimH, they were able to take their software development cycles down from 135 minutes build time to 14 minutes. So it's not that I encourage this because SimH is supported by me and a handful of volunteers in our copious free time. And there is a commercial VAX simulator, a wonderful one called Sharon VAX, which was fully supported. HP will sell you a license on it, etc. But the government program involved had some reservations about it because, of course, it was developed in Russia. We are working on more real-world interactivity. That's probably the number one request. Graphics has been a casualty of the portability problem. When we started, VMS, Unix, Mac, Windows, trying to do common graphics was just sort of close to insolvable. Now, with Mac, VMS, and Unix all using X, and with free X servers through Cygwin available readily on Windows, we have a path forward. So what Phil did to get it running is kind of the prototype of what we'll be bringing out, which is a general-purpose way of emulating graphics. Blinking lights, and then access to raw devices so that people can just attach real disks and use them as raw devices or real CD readers or real floppies. So my last part is sort of a plea to everybody in the audience about sort of what you can do, not just in SimH, but in preservation in general. One of the simplest things is check your attic. Or if you're not of my generation, check your father's attic, or maybe it's your grandfather's attic. But there's still a ton of stuff that's in private hands. You heard me, talk to Selim saying, you've got GRI 909 stuff. Everything about the GRI 909 that I would ever want is locked up in Saul Dinman's attic down on Cape Cod. And he, for some reason, he's very reluctant to go through it. The risk of the loss of computing's past through simple discarding is enormous. Stuff has been thrown out that just is irreplaceable. If you're in doubt about whether an artifact is valuable, you can consult the Computer History Museum people in California. They're happy to talk to you. Or you can talk to Selim or myself or any of the other collectors. We have a good sense of sort of what's needed and what's duplicate. In terms of SimH, if you're not busy this week, you might want to write or adopt a simulator because there are still lots of interesting machines to do. International machines are unrepresented. West Coast machines are poorly represented. And you never do forget your first computer. Probably would like to, but you might be able to sort of unhaunt yourself, write a simulator and say, well, that wasn't so bad, or maybe it was. But most important, people need to be involved. Preservation of computing's history is not for institutions or government at this point. It's not a priority for them any more than the preservation of old cars is. I mean, it's old cars are available because people care about them and they take the time to preserve them. If we're going to have computing history available for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, if it's going to be possible to write the history of computing 50 or 100 years from now, it's going to be because of the activities of people like yourselves and others who take the time to care about it. So that's my urgent plea for everyone is it depends on us. It doesn't depend on museums. It doesn't depend on abstractions. It depends on individuals. Thank you. That concludes the talk, and I'm happy to answer questions about SIMH or conduct additional demos. We are very close to being out of time. In fact, we are out of time. Thank you.